ghostly things are gonna happen. The children could see, but I can't find them for the life of me. And there's Halloween spooks outside my window frame.
Trick or treat? That's a question that's raised at Halloween, but it's also a question that we're raising these days with our own government. You know, is it a trick, all of this spying scandal that we're reading about and hearing about, or is somewhere in all of this something that's really benefiting the American people? Of course, most of the major media would lend themselves to the latter explanation. We need to do it. All countries do it, and we're going to do it too. However, there are disturbing issues here that need to be addressed and need to be discussed. And we're very pleased here on News Dissector Radio to invite and have with us Colleen Rowley. And I'll tell you more about her. She's a former FBI person and 9/11 whistleblower who came to attention when Time magazine put her on the cover as one of the persons of the year in 2002 with two other women credited as whistleblowers. So Colleen Rowley is on with us from her base of action in Minnesota. So we'll chat with her. Just want to introduce myself for those who don't know me. I'm Danny Schechter, your News Dissector. This is News Dissector Radio, heard every week at this time. I'm the editor of MediaChannel.org and also blog at NewsDissector.net. And I'm here on Progressive Radio Network every Thursday from 5 to 6. The call-in number here, 888-874-4888. That number again, 888-874-4888, prn.fm. And you can also listen in on the phones at 619-550-0869. 619-550-0869. Now, I've gotten all of this obligatory information out, most of which has probably sailed right by you because none of us ever have pens or, you know, the ability to write all this down necessarily while we're listening. But here it is, and there you are, and I'm pleased you're with us. Colleen Rowley, you were a special agent with the FBI. You were assigned to Omaha, Nebraska, then Jackson, Mississippi. Beginning in 1984, you spent 6 years working in the New York Office of Investigators looking into organized crime. You were at the U.S. Embassy in Paris and the consulate in Montreal. You were assigned to the Minneapolis office of the FBI. But then something happened, September 11th, 2001, and your secret or not so secret involvement with the FBI suddenly became very public when you began to call attention to information about terrorism that the FBI itself had not really identified or talked about, and that there was more to all of this. And you were one of the few with the courage to go public. Tell us about that, just to establish yourself a little bit, and then let's talk about the NSA.
Sure. Thanks for the nice introduction.
I'm really good at that. I'm a good introducer.
Yeah, you'd be surprised, though. Most people get things wrong because over media especially distorts so much.
Really? I think we agree on that.
but in any event, the nutshell of the 9/11 is that afterwards there began to be a significant large cover-up. I'm sure this occurred in all the 16 intelligence agencies, but I could see what was going on in the FBI. There was actually even a meeting on Halloween the month after October, the end of October, after 9/11.
So this is the anniversary of that meeting, actually. Yes, tonight. Isn't that interesting?
Oh, my gosh.
Woo!
Today, they called offices in, the Phoenix office, because they had sent a memo in to watch flight schools for terrorist suspects. And we don't know what the ins and outs of that, but later on it was denied that the people at headquarters had read that memo. So there was a day where they called in office personnel to get the story straight. They were going to put this out, and then they began to do a timeline. The timeline was selective. They would pick things in there that made them look good, but leave out the things that made them look bad. So 8.5 months afterwards, the first Senate intelligence, it was called the Joint Intelligence Committee Inquiry. JICI was the, J-I-C-I, was the acronym.
I love the acronyms, don't you?
And it was, House and Senate. And they were calling people in to ask them questions. These 30-some staffers that were almost all retirees, also from the intelligence community. And there were minders in those things. There was in our FBI one, the minder happened to be a 31-year-old FBI lawyer who had himself been accused of covering up the Danforth inquiry of Waco. So this is how these things run. You know, it's like nothing is learned, and there's always a cover-up of a cover-up. I mean, I don't even know how many nth degrees this goes. But in any event, I determined I should put it down in writing simply because I knew that I would forget things when I was talking. And this memo I wrote that I handed to the staffers, and then I also took the extra step. This is the part that probably was considered shocking. I actually hand-delivered it to the Senate Intelligence Committee members that I had seen their names in the paper. In hindsight, they probably weren't the best people to have given it to. I gave it to Shelby, Richard Shelby.
From the good,
great state of
Alabama.
Yep, and Dianne Feinstein.
Okay.
And, Feinstein was not the head of the committee at the time. The reason I did was because I saw a news article while I was writing this, and they were asking questions. Those were the two that were asking questions. I just saw their names. So instead of just letting it sit with that, those staffers and the minder that could have possibly excluded part of that, I hand-delivered it to their offices, and then a day or two later, somehow it did get leaked. It wasn't actually me. So I was probably one of the last whistleblowers. If you look at 2002 and 2003, this was probably the one moment, because Sharon Watkins was in Enron complaining to her boss, Kenneth Lay, that their Enron was built on a slippery slope. And then the other one was Cynthia Cooper at WorldCom, who wanted to audit Bernie Ebers. So there were three females whistleblowers in Time Magazine. I don't know if it was more, maybe it was flukish because they had actually selected Bush and Cheney that year, pre-selected them to be Time Person of the Year, but for whatever reason, they picked us instead at the last minute. And since that time, whistleblowing has just gotten a worse and worse reputation, in the sense that the government is now prosecuting whistleblowers as if they are spies. They've conflated people like Robert Hansen and Aldrich Ames, who were true FBI and CIA spies, who sold secrets that got people killed to the Soviet Union. Very, very different with what Edward Snowden and Tom Drake and a whole series of people who have disclosed illegal actions on the part of the government.
So this must have been quite a shock to you, just as a, you know, as a person. Here you are working in, you know, in the FBI, kind of, you know, maybe not as a top secret person, but certainly, you know, it wasn't something that you talked about a lot at, you know, at the mall, you know, that you were working at the FBI, and suddenly you're on the cover of Time Magazine. How did that help change your life? How did you react to that? Because you've become so much more political and more aware since then, haven't you?
Well, it's the thing that shocked me was the extent. I didn't realize there would be this kind of a cover-up. I mean, I knew people would be loath to tell the truth, especially when, you know, 3,000 people died and it was so terrible. And I will say I not only was shocked about how that cover-up occurred, even with Mueller, the highest FBI director, he was only 1 week in the FBI before 9/11. And so if you think about it, why did he have such an incentive to go along with this? You know, in his case, he could have easily said, you know, I wasn't here, I didn't do these things. And I had seen that with Louis Freeh, too. Waco and Ruby Ridge scandals had
well,
occurred.
Well, isn't there a kind of get along, you know, go along to get along attitude? You know, I won't, expose you if you don't expose me. Mm-hmm. This kind of thing.
Yeah, it that obviously is what's going on here. I was going to mention Free. It only wasn't the director in charge of Ruby Ridge or Waco, and yet he still had that incentive to cover up things and whatever. So it was shocking. And the other part that was shocking is as the information dribbled out, and I will say I'm proud that my memo served as a impetus for an inspector general investigation. It's very difficult to get those inspector generals to investigate. You can't
They're
just
so
say.
They're so busy, Colleen. You know, those inspector generals, they have so much to inspect. They don't have time to really look into for the truth. You know, they're too busy.
Well, they have small staffs, and probably deliberately they have small staffs. Of all of the funds, you know, the trillions of dollars that have gone into both the military and the security surveillance complex since 9/11, do you know what? I don't think their inspector generals have grown much. I think that they keep them deliberately small. And one time one of them actually explained, an assistant inspector general said, well, we have to really pick our fights. We have to be very selective because we just can't investigate everything.
Right. Well, let's say that that's the case. But now we're facing, what was a problem, what was an issue, what was something that we debated, you know, about national security, balance, you know, and freedom and all the rest of it. Now this has become a massive global issue.
Yeah.
Largely because of one fellow whistleblower of yours who you didn't know, but you've since met, Edward Snowden. You were part of the group that visited with Snowden in Russia, I'm told. Can you tell us a little bit about what he's like and what that meeting was like?
Well, all whistleblowers that I've met are extraordinary because essentially they are one out of a million. I mean, there are approximately 5 million individuals now with top secret clearances in this new little brother, big brother, whatever you want to call it. And very few have had either the courage or their wits about them. He's very intelligent. Snowden is not a low-level analyst. He was actually a person who had administrative authority, and he had that administrative authority for a reason. He's a very intelligent person and very well-grounded. And, sometimes the trauma of speaking out and losing your friends and having to completely switch from your prior environment, your family, your friends, all desert you. The trauma itself can almost give people a nervous breakdown, even if they were well balanced ahead of time. We had a laboratory whistleblower, Frederick Whitehurst, very smart guy, and you know when they demonized him and whatever, he kind of went off the deep end afterwards.
We know that Daniel Ellsberg also, you know, had issues after he exposed the secret history of the Vietnam War, and that's when Nixon authorized the break-in in his psychiatrist's office. Okay,
uh-huh.
In other words, they were really trying to demonize him, but he maintained his clarity and his convictions, and as have you. So here you are in Russia. What was it like to be part of this group to meet Edward Snowden? What were you expecting, and what did you find?
Well, it was a great opportunity. We did get several hours to talk with him and learn a few things, I guess a few tidbits that are not in the mainstream media. One is his focus is on reform. Now, when you read most of these personalized articles about him, you would never realize that really he's just completely focused on getting this fixed. Maybe that's too boring for articles. They want to talk about his girlfriend and, I mean, all these other things. But he is, his essential motivation for, you know, sacrificing so much is that he saw this was just terrible and even going in a worse direction. And he realized if somebody was not able to get the truth out to the American public and now, of course, even to the citizens of the world and the other world leaders, that it would just continue to go in that direction. And so his focus is on how counterproductive, and he seemed to believe that if people would learn about how bad this is, it's not helping our security, And certainly it's hurting us economically, and on the legal sphere, it's hurting us. You know, our democracy is in danger. The freedom of press is in danger. He thought if people learned about that, that there would then be a reform. So we talked a lot about that. And of course, just a couple of days ago, the first bill was introduced that looks like it is at least a decent step in the right direction.
This is the American Freedom Act to try to challenge the Patriot Act, or at least maybe replace the Patriot Act, which was a kind of a blanket authorization for the government to do whatever it wanted without any real debate. I mean, we learned later that most members of Congress never read it.
Yes, I think only Wisconsin's, who was it in Wisconsin, the senator? He's the only one who read it. he got pushed out afterwards, too.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah, but the author, one of the main authors of the Patriot Act is Sensenbrenner, conservative Wisconsin House rep, and he now is the author, the sponsor of the USA Freedom Act, and so that's telling you something. You've had this complete...
In other words, people can shift in their views and be reflective and decide to speak out on issues that you wouldn't expect them to speak out on, just as I guess even members of your own family were surprised to find you on the... I mean, they knew how outspoken you were privately, but to find you on the front lines of challenging your own government, that takes a lot.
You know, what takes a lot is, again, if you... The idea that your friends now kind of like raise their eyebrows, and you know, even if they agreed with you, and in my office I wasn't saying anything that tons of other people knew. The case agent, of course, testified truthfully at Moussaoui's trial that this was a case of criminal negligence. I mean, he was unbelievably strong. So lots of people knew this, but it was this additional step of, you know, taking it outside the so-called system. And in my case, it wasn't so much outside the system. I was taking it to whom the people in the Oversight Intelligence Committee that I thought should have a way of knowing. I found out later that the FBI considered even people like Dianne Feinstein not to be authorized. I mean, I didn't realize that. I have to say, I was a legal counsel, and I never realized that the executive branch treated the congressional branch as almost an outsider.
Yeah, well, that's interesting, too, because the oversight that should be taking place here hasn't been taking place, and that people who get into these positions and have these, you know, off-the-record, top-secret briefings and all the rest of that, they begin to identify with the surveillance state, with the security state, rather than with the public who expect them to actually be their voice in the process. And so they end up apologizing for, defending, rationalizing what the government is doing and actually helping to conceal it, to cover it up.
That's exactly right. They little by little become complicit. Recently with the drone assassination memo, when John Brennan was being confirmed, you had only the top chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee who had been allowed to see the actual legalization memos. And eventually that leverage of holding back Brennan's confirmation, then the rest of the Senate Judiciary finally, you know, it was like pulling teeth, were led one by one into a skiff. Skiff are those lead-based little rooms where they're totally secure.
Lead-based. In other words, to prevent surveillance, even in the Congress. There are these, like, secret rooms within the Congress.
Now, after 9/11, they're all over. There were only a few before 9/11. Now they're all over. All the agencies have built these skiffs to make it seem like it's so top secret, you know, special. It reminds me of Get Smart and the Cone of Silence a little bit.
Uh-huh.
But when they read those memos, they were not allowed to take notes. They were not allowed to bring a legal counsel with them, and they had minders, and so it's. You know, I think they had to speed read is what they had to do. And so when you're reading legal sophistry like that, especially if you're somebody who doesn't have the background, and then you're in a speed reading exercise, now, afterwards, they can say, we briefed you. Okay, so you're complicit,
right.
Even though you probably didn't even know what you were reading, and there are secret buzzwords that if you didn't know what the secret, like in the drone memo, it's imminent. The word imminent is in there, and they changed the meaning of the word imminent. So if you didn't know some of these things, but then same thing happened with Nancy Pelosi on the torture issue. She was also briefly briefed about black sites and stuff. And then afterwards, when she wants to get some accountability, they pointed her and they say, Nancy, we briefed you.
Right.
You
know, so all of this is really fudging. It's a Orwell in action, so to speak. You know, where what's truth is false. What's false is truth. Just quickly, because I want to get to this NSA thing, and we're just in this fascinating conversation. But you came away feeling that Snowden is sincere about what he's doing. You came away feeling he's a person of integrity. Because, of course, he's been smeared by many media outlets.
Yes, he has been. Initially, of course, he was called every name in the book. And as time has gone on, you have had some people like in the Washington Post, this Roger Cohen. Richard Cohen. He wrote a kind of a mea culpa. Well, I was wrong about Snowden. He does not seem to be motivated. Well, he's not writing a book. He didn't sell this to the movie rights, etc. And so he seems to say he's now the real deal. So there are some people changing that way. There are others, though, who are actually changing because of the issue now of revealing the secrets of surveillance of Germany and France and Brazil and Mexico, that the true nationalist people are saying, well, you're helping those other countries, and I care about only the United States. And if that means we have to spy on the whole world, so there's that element.
So I just read an article, which is kind of interesting, saying that in surveilling Angela Merkel in Germany, you know, her conversations, for example, with Barack Obama, they were also spying on Barack Obama. In other words, our own president was being spied on without really disclosure. What do you make of the scale, the industrial scale of all this, all of the telecommunications companies, you know, being either used or abused or voluntarily going along with it, Google, Yahoo, et cetera, and so forth? Isn't there going to be some pushback? I mean, this is a disgrace of a tremendous scale.
You know, you said pushback, but I'll use the term blowback, which is the CIA term. One of the potential repercussions, for instance, in the international area, and it's why we shouldn't be doing this, is because the intelligence agencies, certainly of our allies, but even of Russia, for instance, share information with the United States that is actually valuable in detecting or could be or should be valuable in reducing terrorism. And the case was the Sarnoff brothers in the Boston Marathon bombing. That was not even an ally. That was Russia that gave us that information. Now, you can imagine that this spying is hurting the trust relationship between countries, and to the extent that Germany and France, who were very much cooperating on the issues of terrorism, to the extent that they might have lost some of their trust and won't be quite as forthright or whatever, I mean, this is going to hurt our own security.
This guy Clapper seems like, you know, he's quoting movies, you know, he's quoting all sorts of, you know, bizarre, you know, kind of rationalizations for all of this. The movie Casablanca, you know, comes to mind. You know, so there seems to be a kind of crazy, you know, almost like, something that's almost belongs in a movie.
Well, the NSA's office space, their whole entire thing is designed to be the set of the Enterprise in Star Trek.
Is that right?
And yeah, they actually have a Captain Kirk seat where Keith Alexander sat in front of a big screen. And the people from the Star Trek were the designers of that office. I mean, so you're saying these people are delusional? Yes, obviously. Google that article about how they made the NSA office
This is the first time I've, PRN, this is, listeners, this is something we haven't really heard before, and it's probably the tip of the iceberg, so to speak, the way these guys think of themselves and their right to information, no matter what anybody else's rights are, to privacy.
The office was named the Information Dominance Center. Information Dominance Center. I'm not making this up. Google it. It's pretty incredible.
So, you know, kind of, I'm sure the dominance, official dominance profession here in New York would identify with this also. You know, it seems like we're losing any expectation of coherent policies. And, you know, where is President Obama in all of this? Why does he do this? What is the rationale? Do the presidents and all these officials just get co-opted by their intelligence agencies? Do they fear that they're going to be spied on next? What is your understanding of why this is going on? Because it's doing so much harm to American prestige and respect for the United States all over the world.
Two or three reasons. One is the secrecy alone. When any group, and I don't even care if it's an otherwise good group of high integrity that is allowed to be secret, in a few years, you will see that the secrecy degenerates the actions of the group. It at the very least makes them reckless because they realize that no one will ever know. It's a basic tenet of ethics that your actions be open, and people would say, well, if your grandmother was looking over your shoulder, would you do it? If you knew that it was going to be in the newspaper tomorrow, would you do it? In the FBI, for instance, when we had the legal wiretapping of the mafia in New York when I worked in the 1980s, we did have a lot of wiretaps of different mafia families. They took about 2 years of work, of legwork, to get the probable cause to take to a district judge to sign off on a 100-page affidavit in order to do that. And we knew the reason that people were very careful and judicious was because you knew that when that ended, that the paperwork, the affidavit, the draft warrant, all of that was going to be turned over to a defense attorney and to a judge, and they were going to look at every single thing to make sure every T was crossed and every I dotted.
So there was transparency, there was accountability, there was law, okay?
Yes.
Now it seems and as it, if the, it's a rogue, you know, world that we're in. If you can get away with it, go for it.
That's right. And you know, the law is only as good as it's enforced. So what NSA has been doing is coming up with secret interpretations of law. Actually, the whole intelligence community has been doing this. Well, why? Because they realize that no one ever examined the torture issue. There's a 6,000-page report that cost taxpayers $40 million to prepare that the Senate Intelligence Committee still has classified secret all this time. Now, if you're in a system like that, you see Jose Rodriguez, who was one of the CIA torture architects, you see him writing a book for millions, you see George Tenet getting a $4 million advance writing his book about how torture works, etc., and you know that the truth, the 6,000-page report, is buried and will never see the light of day. And by the way, Obama's behind that too. He's the person holding it up.
What is with him? He's a constitutional lawyer. He's a former professor at Harvard. He was the great hope of so many people. What happened?
You know, the system, in all fairness, here's the defense I would make, is since I want to play devil's advocate here, and I'm not a fan at all of Obama. I've criticized Obama. I was one of the first people. I voted for him in 2008, but not in 2012. I voted for him the first time.
Me
only.
Too.
And even then, my hope, my so-called hope, was not that high. I actually had pretty low expectations for him the first time. And then, of course, those were dashed when he escalated the war in Afghanistan.
Yeah, but I think something happened. You know, on that day, he gets into office and he's going to sign this executive order to close Guantanamo. And then it doesn't happen, does it? Somebody talked to him. Somebody says, no, you don't want to do that for this several hundred reasons, whatever. I mean, they must have stuff on him, too.
Well, that's very likely. Of course, he was involved in Chicago's corrupt situation there, and other people around him were indicted and went off to prison. So, yes, that's true enough. In secret systems, when they really get corrupt and they go out of control, and then you come along later as a reformer, there's really probably only a couple of ways that you can have enough power and momentum to do that. And he's coming along, you know, years after this has started. It's almost kind of like the law of physics, where something is moving in a certain direction. One way he could have done this, you're right about he did at least take the steps of signing those orders. But what he should have done is when he was giving his inauguration speech to the 2-3 million people out there, he should have said, you know, this is going to be really difficult. I know you elected me to do stuff, to close Guantanamo, to stop the abuses, etc. But it's not going to be easy, and I want you all just to sit right down here and occupy Washington until it's done.
Okay. Occupy Washington.
Yeah, that's what he should have done. And he should have said, you know, I'm going to try to do this in 2 weeks. I'm going to try to, you know, sign every executive order to change this. But I know without the people, it's going to, this is what FDR said, by the way. It's exactly what FDR said. Without people making me do it. And he wasn't maybe smart enough to realize that. And so he thought, you know, and he, of course, was greatly mistaken. He did try to get the, some of the torture memos released initially on, and all seven former CIA directors immediately read him the Riot Act about that.
Right.
And
so
there
were
other things.
There's a lot of pressure that comes down from within the system. Colleen Rowley, I love you. You are the most articulate, principled person, and I really respect your stance and your insights into all of this. I hope the listeners realize what a treat it is on this Halloween. And not a trick, but a treat to have Colleen Rowley here from City of Minneapolis, which just elected a new mayor. Not true?
Not till November 5th, I think.
Oh, okay. But
we're going to get one November 5th. Yep.
So, Colleen, thank you so much for coming on our program. I'd love to have you back on because this conversation is just getting going, and I think we're doing a good job of discussing this. You know, in a really interesting way. I hope you agree, because you've been on every show there is. But I think this conversation has been one of the best I've had on the radio in a long, long time. And I want to thank you so much for coming on with us and talking about this. Colleen, do you have a website? Do you have any? I know you write also.
I write a lot at Consortium News. I used to write a little more for Huffington Post. But if you Google Colleen Rowley and Huffington Post, you'll see a lot of my older stuff. And lately I've been writing a little more for Consortium News and antiwar.com.
We had Bob Parry, the editor, on our program. He's brilliant, and Consortium News is an important media outlet. So thank you, Colleen Rowley. We're going to be back in a little bit. We're going to be talking to somebody who's actually has been a muckamuck within the system, talking about progressive broadband and progressive communication. So stay with us here on News Dissector Radio on PRN FM.
I'm just an average man with an average life. I work from 9 to 5. Hey, hell, I pay the price. All I want is to be left alone in my average home.
Every breath you take, and every move you make, every bond you break, every step you take.
You. I hope they're watching the police, and not us, because they are watching us right now, and I don't like it for one. Joining us now on News Dissector Radio here on PRN FM is Ev Ehrlich. I hope I have the name right.
You bet you do.
To talk a little bit about broadband and telecommunications. You know, the importance of media, the importance of the telecommunications infrastructure can't be overstated. It's not surprising that the NSA is spying on Google and Yahoo and other telecommunications giants. It's not surprising that control of the media is something that, of course, the media wants to hold on to. And now we have a new FCC commissioner, Tom Wheeler, confirmed that an appointee of President Obama, not known as a public interest advocate, but as a corporate guy who's now coming in to run the FCC. So we're in a situation that, because of all of this shutting down of the government and all of the partisan wars that we've been through, the whole issue of communication seems to have been lost, or at least not being discussed. Certainly, the last thing that's ever discussed in the media is the media, often, particularly because of the powerful self-interest of the media companies. I used to work for ABC News, for CNN, for CNBC. I've been on the inside, and now I edit MediaChannel.org, which is a website which attempts, anyway, to be a watchdog of the media system. So, Eric, you're the president of ESC Company, a D.C.-based economics and business consulting firm that works with some Fortune 500 companies as well as nonprofits. You're a former Undersecretary of Commerce for Economic Affairs, a Vice President for Strategic Planning and Chief Economist at UNCES. How do you say that?
Unisys
Corporation. But also there in your background lurking is the fact that you are a legislative assistant to my man, John Conyers. The oldest serving member of Congress from Detroit, who was the chairman of the Judiciary Committee and is now protesting against the Judiciary Committee.
Right.
But at any rate, you've been very concerned about these issues, net neutrality and the whole infrastructure of media and who it serves and who it's responsible to. So tell us a little bit about how your concerns about all this developed. I mean, you're an insider, outsider, but also outspoken.
Well, I think I'm all three of those things. I appreciate that. I was working for President Clinton and for Secretary Ron Brown 20 years ago when we were trying to figure out what this Internet thing was going to be. And that produced a law, the 1996 Telecommunications Act, and that established a whole new framework for the Internet that gave us the remarkable stuff that's going on today. I mean, you think about the communications abilities you have. You've got a device in your hand that can give you the sum of all human knowledge in the history of civilization. It's just unbelievable. The framework that President Clinton created 20 years ago, and it wasn't like wingnut Tea Party guys, it was us who said, look, we do not have the money to build this thing, so we're going to let companies build it, but they've got to compete and they've got to behave responsibly. And in fact, looking at today's paper, the problem is really more these NSA guys than it is the companies themselves. But we get to go to the next level, I think, and really take the steps to turn the broadband Internet into what it could be, because it's now remarkable. But I think that progressives need to think about how do we get this into everybody's hands and how do we use this to turn the healthcare system into something that can reach everyone through different ways of delivering medical services? How do we use it to turn the school system into something that glistens and that's beautiful as opposed to that's rotting away at the inside? And that ought to be the agenda. And I say that, and I think everyone listens to progressive radio as I do, thinks, well, of course that's what we want to do, but that's not what our agenda appears to be right now.
What are the forces shaping this media agenda? They seem to be very privatized. You know, broadband in America is more expensive than broadband in many other parts of the world. It's not accessible still to a lot of people. There is a digital divide very much in place here and dealing with the growing inequality in our society. We have the voices of the public interest in this whole debate are kind of muted and not given much of a chance to be seen or heard. And so it's hard to have a debate when one side of the debate, is kind of shut out of it.
Look, both, the remarkable thing about the agenda that we're busy arguing about now, which is really net neutrality, right? That's not a debate between businesses and the public. It's a debate between some businesses and other businesses, right? Net neutrality says that everything travels on the same terms. It's like the Red Guard and everybody in Chairman Mao's land wears the same clothes, or everybody on the highway has to travel at the same speed. That, you know, Verizon, Comcast, Time Warner, AT&T, those companies, they don't much care for that. But the reason why that's an argument is because it's good for Google, Amazon, Yahoo, eBay, particularly Netflix, because it says that a high definition video on Netflix or YouTube, which is the equivalent of an 18-wheel truck, has to travel on the same terms as an email that you send to your friend, which is the equivalent of a Vespa motor scooter. So I think we've been caught up in this debate where one bunch of companies wants one thing and another bunch of companies wants the other. And it's my hope that Tom Wheeler, who does have a business background, but who was supported, in essence, by a lot of the groups like Public Knowledge and so on, is in a position to take us to the next level, work this nonsense out between the companies.
I'm glad you mentioned Public Knowledge. You know, this is one of a number of public interest groups that have been very vocal and very smart about telecommunications policy as advocates in Washington. They may not get heard or seen very much in our television sets, but they are listened to among people who know what's going on. But the problem is that the public, the consumers, the people who are paying increasingly larger percentages of their, you know, of their resources for these services, don't have much of a say. You know, in other words, if I'm a Google, you know, subscriber or whatever, and you know, there's a box, you know, you have to agree to our terms of service. So here's an 18-page document that
no one
ever reads. And you check it. You say agree. Okay, you agree because there's an element of trust there that they are serious about their commitment to privacy, for example, and respecting your privacy, for example. And then you find out that these companies are colluding with the NSA, and they're being often reimbursed for any staff time, you know, that they invest in trying to help the NSA spy on their own customers. I mean, that's a disgraceful, you know, kind of lack of an agreement. You know, nobody agreed to that when we check agree.
Well, you know, is that ever right? And I read in the paper today that they're getting hacked themselves. There's no honor among thieves, you know. But I think that I think it's a good example of what the agenda ought to be. We're busy arguing about, you know, the terms on whether or not your cardiac monitor ought to travel the internet at, you know, on the same terms as a video of a cat playing a xylophone. But the real issues are we going to close a digital divide? Are we going to revolutionize our schools and hospitals? Are we going to protect the integrity of people's participation in the internet? You know, I don't mind, for example, if Google looks at the number of searches for respiratory ailments and ends up better able to predict where the flu epidemic is than the Center for Disease Control. That's cool, but I do mind if they start profiling me without my consent, right? Or sharing, you know, stuff that's the actual content of what I'm doing, which is completely beyond the pale. I don't know the extent to which those latter and more egregious violations are going on. We're just finding that out, right? But that really ought to be the progressive agenda.
I mean, it is certainly a big question mark, you know, about the role that companies are playing. But the question is also how active or proactive are the people in government who are supposed to oversee all of this? How influential are they when they are confronted with very well-paid lobbyists from every one of these companies advocating for their particular interest and trying to undo a regulation that they think might be onerous towards them, et cetera, and so forth. You know, it's not as if it's a fair marketplace where everybody has their say fairly and then somebody decides. You know, it's a marketplace that's bullied by lobbyists of all kinds.
Look, that is a problem that's endemic to our society. It's more than telecommunications. You understand that. Our listeners understand that. And I think that we've learned in the last month, watching this shutdown thing play out, a couple of things. One is that a lot of the power that these guys have comes from gerrymandering and arranging districts so they're not contestable. And at that point, the most extreme factions get to call the shots. I think we also saw, and I think this is fascinating, that you've got some corporate-type Republicans who are looking up and thinking, these wing nuts over on the right are crazy and bad for business. So we're in very interesting times this way. You know, because of Citizens United, there are few, if any, limits now on the kinds of private resources that go into elections. We've got better laws than we used to about registering lobbyists and understanding their activities, but they have become such an essential part of the system in terms of making the offices of representatives and senators work that they really got to be dug out tooth and branch.
You're a very smart guy. You're a PhD. You went to Stony Brook. You went to the University of Michigan, mm-hmm. I guess in Ann Arbor.
But, yes, go blue.
But also, you went to New York City public schools like I did. And
oh, yeah?
I think that's where your pragmatism comes from. DeWitt Clinton High School in the Boogie Down Bronx is the
very
high school
nice.
That
Duke
I went
Down
to.
High School in Queens.
So there you go. See, uh-huh. New York City mm-hmm. educational system, which is now facing a big, big challenge.
Yep.
We're hoping that Mr. de Blasio, who we hope will be elected, many of us will be able to bring some resources into the educational system.
I'm with you there.
But, you know, obviously every educator is facing this question also with kids that are often more tech savvy than the teachers, you know, who are, you know, on their phones, on their devices, you know, on their iPads, you know, a lot, you know, and not necessarily in a thoughtful way. You know, in other words, there's still a problem of media literacy here for the public to be able to be more effective in influencing the direction things are going.
Look, does that go to it, because, you know, the broadband internet is potentially the greatest avenue for political and economic citizenship that the world's ever seen in terms of people educating themselves and expressing themselves and the way we teach kids. I was talking to a science teacher the other day. He says that, you know, everybody in science and math used to hate word problems, right? Like, you know, if Joe has got a garden that's this many feet by this many feet, how many feet of fence does he need, and that kind of stuff. And then she showed me how you can teach that by saying, okay, let's go find a picture of, you know, a garden on a map, and let's measure it using the internet, and then let's go to, like, the Home Depot website and see what it costs to get fencing and teach people real-world applications. There are ways to do that in all these disciplines, and it's going to require some resources. It's going to require experimentation, right? And it means that districts that don't have substantial amounts of income and the kinds of property tax bases that produce those are going to need some help if you want our society to prosper a generation from now.
You know, particularly in fairness, I mean, I was just reading today about, you know, only 15% of the college students who want to go into the humanities at all anymore. Everybody sees college as a way to get a job, you know, and, you know, so if the most money is being made on Wall Street, they want to be there. There's something that's out of whack with this system, because on the other hand, on the internet, you have this incredibly diverse range of websites and resources that people can access. So, you know, the problem is that going to Google and you know, putting in a problem, you might see the first top five sites, but you don't necessarily get a tutorial on how to think about this.
No, we've got to provide those through the school system. But, you know, then again, that goes to it. Look, I'm not going to hassle a kid who wants to get a job when he gets out of college. I am going to be concerned about a system where we have them pile on debt. But at the same time, if I look at the broadband world, we're going to be developing new ways of teaching people. I mean, what people call massive online courses, you know, is really the beginning of it.
Coursera.
You know, it's a fascinating thing. You know where the system of lecturers lecturing to a college class, that comes from the Middle Ages when they could only afford one copy of a handwritten book. So the cat read it to everybody else, and that's where the lecture system comes from. It's 1,000 years old. I bet it's ready to change.
I think it is changing in a profound way. Also, you know, the fact that we even have stations like this one at PRN-FM, you know, which is attempting to offer a wider range of perspectives and to talk about these things. I mean, you know, the fact that you came to me through a corporate PR firm, I would normally, you know, say, no, I want some angrier rhetoric. But no, I want to talk to somebody who's in the middle of this fight, who understands it on the inside and can help us figure out how we can leverage our concerns and get more, you know, opportunities for people, because we need to do that too.
That's right. I appreciate your saying that, and I think that we've got to look up and think what's really important to us. You know, I think that there are people on the right who think that if people don't have the internet and broadband, it's because they're lazy and stupid, right? And I mean, it's the same crap we've been seeing for, you know, throughout American society, with blaming the poor and making, you know, blaming them for their own situation, blaming the victim. And I think it's also true that on the left, we look at a decision that basically was made in the Clinton administration to let companies build this stuff, and we say, well, it's, you know, we can't have that. There's no alternative. It's too late. We've got to work with these guys and come up with a way to extend this stuff. You know, I've met a lot of people who think, well, the government ought to own the internet. It will cost $500 billion to build, and right now we're fighting to put food stamps
in the pocket. Considering that Al Gore created the internet, I mean, couldn't
you know,
he have
look,
just
poor
put
it? Poor Vice President Gore. And I say this as
I'm saying that kiddingly, you know.
No, but people, you know, he really did understand it, and that's an important thing. What Gore understood is that this is not the phone system on steroids, that this is something completely different, and we can't treat it like the phone system. You know, the phone system, we looked at the Bell companies and we said, okay, we're going to give you a monopoly. Please try not to hurt us too badly, right? But in this world, we're going to rely on competition, and it's going to have private investment in it. We've got to get past that and figure out how to make it work the best possible way.
I guess my only concern is, I agree with you about that, but my only concern about that is that when people get into the corporate world, they're living from quarter to quarter. They're trying to maximize profits. They're trying to keep their jobs, because if there's a setback or there's too much competition, they could be out the door. So there's a tremendous amount of insecurity in the corporate world. You know, you don't have an ability. They used to in Japan, you know, plan over 10 years, you know, longer term planning. It seems like everything is, you know, kind of now. And part of that is the impact of the internet, but also argues for why we need to learn more about how to use it to our own advantage. And I think that's what you're saying here in part.
And that's the bottom line. Amen. That's right. It's out there. It's a remarkable tool. And people have to use it for their individual advantages, to make themselves better, more informed and active citizens. And we have to use it to improve those parts of society that need improvement, like healthcare, like the environment, like the school system, like local governments, right? Those, a lot of those places are doing business the way they did 100 years ago, and we've got to move forward from there.
I mean, I think it is to the credit, for example, of Google, which might... Who knows? You know, they have a secret barge there in San Francisco. They're doing all kinds of secret work. But they did speak out against these abuses by the NSA. They denounced it. They called for reform. And hopefully the corporate world can begin to get engaged a little bit in the civic discourse about trying to encourage debate and discussion about these issues and activate people to care about all of this, because that's our lives here. Many of us are living our lives online increasingly. There are a lot of problems with this. You know, kids do it that are, you know, 2 years old having telephones and going to sleep with them, and you know, parents giving their kids iPads to keep them busy. You know, there's a lot of problems here as well, but we do need more awareness, certainly net neutrality. Ev Ehrlich, thank you very much for joining us. Our whole conversation could have gone on for another hour. Hopefully, maybe we can have you back on to talk with us some more. You're very articulate, and I think it's important for us to learn from people who are on the inside and debate with them, as I've tried to do a little bit, not too effectively. To get these issues out there, because they are important. And just for your information, Ev, I edit something called mediachannel.org, which is a kind of a media watchdog. We cover these issues. We welcome your any contribution, any articles that you've written that we can aggregate and put into our mix as well. I think you're an important voice in this debate, and I'm glad that you could join us here.
Hey, I'm going to take a look, and I very much appreciate having the chance to be here.
Yes, and my blog is at newsdissector.net, mediachannel.org, prn.fm is our network here, and you can listen to this on our archives. Also, I'll be posting the URL of the actual program. There'll be a podcast of it. We'll send it to you, Ev, also.
Hey, thank you.
Let's continue this discourse and stay with us. Thank you for listening again this week on PRN FM. We hope that our colleague Polar Levine feels better for next week's show. And thank you, Heather, for being in the command module and helping us get this program out to the people.
Abracadabra.